everybody. Welcome to the live retail online integration webinar, How Beating Fraud Can Boost Sales, sponsored by Count. We have two great speakers today, Pam Walsh, the Education Manager at the Merchant Risk Council, and Don Bush, VP of Marketing at Count. I'm Melissa Campanelli, Editor-in-Chief of AM&C and the host of today's event. The rise of card-not-present e-commerce transactions has created a new sophisticated level of international criminals. Merchants have been forced to impose hard and fast rules on which transactions to accept and which to decline. This blanket approach stops many fraudulent transactions, but it also blocks many legitimate, honest consumers in the U.S. and worldwide. This webinar will explain how new hosted fraud platforms can instantly detect both fraudulent orders and legitimate orders, reducing detection time and increasing sales. Key highlights include why a low chargeback rate may actually be costing you money, the real cost of manual reviews and rule-based fraud detection, the importance of overseas markets for U.S.-based e-commerce growth, how to sell more to more people in more places, and a case study review of bodybuilding.com. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, please troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions during at the end of the hour. You can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. Speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experiences today. With that, let's take it away, Pam.
Thank you very much, Melissa. I'm very happy to be with you today and to present some information about the Merchant Risk Council. The MRC is a nonprofit trade association founded in 2000 by some of the premier online and multi-channel merchants. Now, the MRC does not serve customers per se, but if consumers find e-commerce and mobile commerce to be safer and more efficient, ultimately we will achieve our mission of making electronic commerce more profitable for all our constituents. MRC's programming objectives consist of four areas: networking, education, benchmarking, and advocacy. Now, with the networking, we provide ways for members to connect with one another and with industry leaders. In education, we have four live events each year, two in the United States, two in Europe, as well as a number of webinars and local training events or roadshows. If you're interested in speaking at one of our events, we'd love hearing from you. Another key area in our education department is the development of a payments and fraud prevention specialist certification program. With benchmarking, we host three annual surveys, fraud, payments, and payment operations, along with ad hoc surveys as requested by our members. Our members really appreciate having the data that is collected right at their fingertips. In regards to advocacy, this objective allows for important conversations to happen between merchants and card brands. Greg Gechner, the MRC Executive Director, has a strong background in advocacy and government relations and is leading us in these efforts. Here's a quick snapshot of the constituents we serve, from multi-channel and e-commerce merchants to credit card issuers. You'll also see some of our merchant member brands on this slide as well. And here's some information on the membership makeup of the MRC. Actually, as of today, we now have 306 merchant companies, representing 1,600 or so individual merchants. We also collaborate with more than 40 sponsor companies, many with a global focus, both on payments and risk, and the car brands are also part of the MRC family as well. And 17% of our members are based in Europe. Now, as a warm-up to Count's presentation on how beating fraud can increase sales, I want to share some of the key things that MRC merchant members are focusing on. We have our largest global event in March, where many of these topics will be covered in depth. The first pillar of our programs is electronic payments fraud prevention. In this area, we pay attention to these issues: industry benchmarking. Every year, we announce the results of our Platinum Fraud Survey. Our members have consistently outperformed the larger sample, and we'll unveil the 2011 results on March 27th at our global annual conference in Vegas. Tools and technology. Our members focus on things such as device recognition, IP geolocation, and other sources of insight into transactions that will help them reject fraud and reduce false positives. Trends. Our members consistently share with one another regarding attacks they are experiencing from certain fraud rings or methodologies. By warning others, they are protecting revenue and consumers. Both the digital and physical merchants have different fraud and chargebacks issues. MRC caters content and programs to serve both. In regards to cross-channel fraud, merchants that sell online and allow store pickup are dealing with logistical, payment, and fraud issues, and we provide a forum for them to connect and learn from one another. And for payments, many of our members have a global perspective and utilize their membership in the MRC to learn about things such as interchange optimization. Our members want to know how to save costs on credit card transactions, emerging payment methods, mobile, direct debit, installment payments, reoccurring payments. These are all topics we cover regularly and bring in some of the best and brightest in the industry to lead education sessions specific to these topics. Regulatory and compliance issues. These vary by country, and we are helping our members navigate the issues that cut across their treasury, operations, IT, and security departments. We work with our members to understand PCI and streamline costs associated with compliance. And finally, we proactively work with issuers and card brands to strengthen communication and increase the quality of the consumer experience. This leads to a reduction in fraud and limits the rejection of good orders from consumers. You can stay on top of the topics and trends I just outlined by attending one or more of these live MRC events in 2012. Our conference in Vegas has some excellent networking opportunities with over 50 education sessions presented by over 100 content expert speakers. And for folks new to the industry, we have two workshops just for you, a Fraud 101 and a Payments 101 workshop. They are 4 hours each and will be offered on March 27th. Our Spring European Congress will be held in Dublin, Ireland, April 25th through the 27th. It's our largest European conference and something you must attend, especially if you're based in Europe or have offices there. And after that is our next European event, the Fall European Conference, which will be held in Rome, Italy, September 10th through the 13th. And finally, the U.S. Fall Conference will be held in Seattle, Washington, the global headquarters for the MRC, October 1st through the 3rd. We really hope to see you at one or more of these industry events. Keep an eye out for the call for presentations that will be coming out, and should you be interested in being a speaker. You're always welcome to also email me at pam@merchantriskcouncil.org if you have any questions. So at this point, I'd like to say thank you to Count and ROI for allowing me to join you today. And should you have any questions about the MRC, we're always here to serve you, and we'd love to hear from you. So, okay, Melissa, I'll just hand it back to you.
Thanks a lot, Pam. Let's see. Don, why don't you take it away on your presentation?
Great. My name is Don Bush. I'm with Count. This presentation, we're going to talk about how a proper fraud management system can actually help boost sales. I know that sounds almost counterintuitive, but we found it over dozens and hundreds of merchants that it actually can work. Our mission here at Count is we want to help our customers win the war on fraud with an operational platform, an all-in-one, easy-to-use system that makes it easy to install and implement and use. What we really want to do is increase revenue without jeopardizing sales, and that's the goal of what we do with all of our customers. Greater visibility with less complexity, and then, of course, speed and accuracy. If you're taking too long to get something back to a customer, it can really, really damage your opportunity to make a sale. In fact, a report just came out this week stating that 28% of consumers have encountered fraud protection system that unnecessarily delayed or denied their transaction. That's huge, 1 out of 4. And what happens is they say about 30 to 40% of those people that have that delay or interruption don't come back, which is very detrimental to any business. Count is an all-in-one strategy. We figure that the fraud is not just a tool here and there or a bundle of tools, but it has to be a complete strategy within the organization, and it manages everything from fraud screening to strategy to actually back into the operations, and we'll go over some of this a little bit later. But let's talk a little bit about what fraud does to a business. Fraud can hurt business in a number of different ways. In 2011, over $100 billion was lost in fraud. A good portion of that is cash in the form of chargeback fees, unrecoverable fees that you have to pay to credit card companies if you're in an excessive chargeback program, money transfers, and so forth. And a lot of that has to do with unrecoverable product, extra costs for doing things like manual reviews and customer support and so forth. It's one of the number one reasons for chargebacks is fraud. The problem is fraudsters are getting more and more complicated, and they're getting more accurate with their networks. Fraud is increasing in their speed, their sophistication, and their networking, and the ways that they have to steal from merchants. Merchants typically are not fraud experts, and so they do that. They take on that task as part of their ongoing business. And so it's very difficult to stop that type of fraud. And oftentimes we don't even know the fraud's happening until we get our chargeback report, 30 to 90 days after the transaction, which makes it even more difficult to manage that. Oftentimes we see people say, well, let's just increase our manual reviews because that would stop our chargeback rate. But then you've got a cost comparison between a chargeback and a manual review, slowed down response to a customer's purchase opportunity. So there's other dominoes that fall when that happens. The cost of fraud, we've already talked about that a little bit. One of the things that I think is important is more than 50% of all chargebacks are directly related to fraud. The average order rejection rate, this is a number that everybody should understand and know in their own business. What is your average order rejection rate? Nationally in the U.S., it's about 2.4%, which means you spend hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands or millions of dollars to get people to your site. They finally go to the page to purchase. You've converted them into a sale, and 2.4% of the time we're rejecting those orders because of suspicion of fraud of some sort. Internationally, that's 7.7%. At Count, what we try and do is reduce that as much as possible so that you can convert more orders to sales. We talk about it in the vein of selling more things to more people in more places. Some of the fraud trends that we see, not only with our own merchants, but with many of the analysts, the MRC, and other groups that we talk to every single week, are starting to affect merchants in ways that maybe they don't see because of the silo effect. We see a reduction in conversion, and that's a sales problem. We see a increase in chargebacks, and that's a finance problem. We see friendly fraud having an issue, and that may be an operations problem. And oftentimes, those symptoms, as we call them, are not viewed holistically across the organization. Some of the trends that we see are we've got to move beyond just chargeback rates. When we have a problem, oftentimes rules engines are fantastic ways to help monitor and manage fraud, but when we get too many rules, they come at a price. New channels and new markets. How do I expand internationally with the confidence that I'm not going to lose my business because of fraud or my risk that goes up there? And then actually turning fraud management into a revenue center. You know, moving beyond chargebacks is where should my chargeback rate be? And one of the things that many operations have difficulty with is optimizing what is a profitable rate of chargeback that maximizes my sales. How does my chargeback rate fit into my fraud strategy? And for instance, if I'm doing shippable goods, hard goods, computers, apparel, those types of things, I've got hard costs and shipping and the product itself. What is an acceptable rate of risk and an acceptable rate of chargebacks for my particular model? In our view, and some of the customers we have, they want to keep that as low as possible, down to that, you know, 20 basis points or lower. If I'm doing digital goods, apps, music, ebooks, those types of things, oftentimes our customers find that a higher rate, maybe even up to 80 to 90 basis points, is acceptable because that maximizes sales and their cost of goods is reduced. How will my current approach scale? We've seen a number of customers that get into fraud trouble or get into chargeback trouble, and all of a sudden they decide that they want to increase manual review. Well, first of all, that's a very difficult approach to scale. If I want to increase my sales this year by 20%, do I need to increase my manual review staff by 20%? Our approach is how can we get that reduced so that fewer human eyeballs have to look at every transaction? And when we look at what will scale and what won't scale, automation is the trend that we need to take advantage of here. Fraud rules do come at a price. Like I said, rules engines are fantastic helps when it comes to screening fraud and possible suspicion of fraud and so forth. We've seen merchants with as many as 2,000 rules. And what that immediately means to us is that their initial screening is just not effective enough. One way or another, they've got to put rules in to filter additional things that their initial fraud detection or screening didn't catch. What's the damage for customer? Frustrations, the insults to a customer. According to the study I just referred to, 35% of those customers are insulted, and they decide to take their business somewhere else. If I delay a purchase or have to do a manual review, delaying that satisfaction of a customer, a fair number of those people will leave and go to a different place for their purchase. One of the things that we need to understand is how to make better decisioning. Just a few years ago, and it's still in the market today, most of the data that we could pull was static payment data. And today, data is becoming more and more dynamic. In this study done by Mercator Advisory Group just last year, they put this chart together that showed how dynamic data is becoming more and more necessary to understand and put into a real-time fraud system. things like proxy detection and device identification. What about third-party data sources? Do I have a VIP or a negative list? What about things like behavioral data and so forth? These things are all changing in real time, and those are the things that we need to take advantage of in order to properly screen fraud and increase our sales. The payments ecosystem is in transition. Static data is no longer adequate. AVS and CVV, those are great things. They're just not enough anymore. New signals such as mobile phones and iPads and game players, all these things now have the ability to buy and have the ability to make a purchase. How can we manage those? The online behavior of customers through CRM, or on the negative side, things like bots and viruses that help pull off fraud techniques without merchants actually seeing some of those things. So better decisioning data is critical.
Actually, you know what, Don, I'm just going to break in here for a second if it's okay.
Sure.
And just from some of the questions that I'm seeing, maybe you could be a little bit clearer about some of the terms you use. For instance, you just used EMC data, I believe. Can you just kind of go over what that means, some of the sort of the basic terms?
AVS and CVV?
Yeah, exactly.
You bet. AVS is Address Verification Service. This is an old technique that's been on the books for years and years and years, and what happens is when you send your approval to the bank, they might run an address verification service to see if your ship to or your bill to address is the same that they have on file. And if it's a match, they'll assume that that must be a good order. Credit card verification service, or CVV or CVS, those are the same things. They'll look at the credit card number, they'll look at the billing address, the name on the card, the name that you submit. They'll look at the three-digit code, some of those different things. And those are all standard practices, but those are very, very easy for fraudsters to mimic or get around. We talk about a proxy detection. And if I'm using AVS or CVV or some of those other, like I said, static fraud tools, it's very easy to get around those in, with tools, things like a proxy. I may be sitting in Vietnam, but I can borrow or rent a proxy in Chicago, and to the merchant, it looks like I'm sitting in Chicago, so it wouldn't create a red flag. And yet the person actually making the purchase is sitting in Vietnam with stolen identification, and they're just masking what they're doing. And that's what some of those services that you find today are including. Does that help, Melissa?
That does. And then the other acronym was EMV. I'm assuming that's electronic merchant verification, or?
It's electronic MasterCard Visa. It's some stuff that MasterCard and Visa do.
Got it. Sorry.
One of the things when you start talking about the dynamic fraud and performance criteria is the speed and flexibility of your system. iTunes and Amazon have made it very difficult now to do things other than instant gratification, and it's very difficult because their processes are very different than most merchants' process. And they're willing to take a larger amount of risk because they share that with the publisher. But smaller merchants, and I mean smaller than Apple, which includes a lot of us, they don't have that luxury. They need to perform things with speed to have a comprehensive fraud control and checks and an interlocking range of customer interactions. One of the things that Pam mentioned just earlier was the MRC does their study every year. This is a study that the MRC completed last year on the number of fraud tools used to put together their fraud system. And you can see from smaller merchants all the way up to the very large merchants, most people are taking a number of tools and trying to put them together and make them work. We find a big problem with that because most tools have not been designed to work with each other. I get a tool from one company and a tool from another company and another tool from another company. They've been designed to work by themselves. And when you try and interact with them, inherently, from the code level, they're not built to work that way. And so it's very difficult to take that information and put together a fraud picture of what's happening. Some of the tools that you'll see on the market and some of the decisioning that you'll see are some of these fraud detection tools. There's lots of them. And I mention a few here just to give you an idea of what's out there and what can happen. Another one of the fraud trends is expanding into new markets. One of the things that we find is a number of companies are very, very hesitant to go into international markets, even from the U.S. to Canada or to Mexico. And it's even more difficult to go into higher-risk countries overseas. And what we find is that people simply just don't accept orders. They simply turn off those geolocations and say, if I get something from the UK, I'm just not going to accept it. Now, if that's a business practice for a business reason, it's totally acceptable. I don't deliver to the UK. I don't have a warehouse in the UK. I can't accept orders from there. But if it's simply a reason because I think the orders are more fraudulent outside the U.S., we look at that as a way that merchants are hindering their own sales. One of the things that we found, especially recently, the Wall Street Journal said 70% of CFOs are looking for foreign markets for their growth, and they expect to generate returns from that, especially during this downturn with the U.S. They're looking outside the U.S. to grow their company, to grow their sales. And we find that customers that turn off countries because they think they're too fraudulent limit their opportunities. We'll talk about this a little bit more in the case study in just a couple of minutes. Some of the other fraud problems that we see as symptoms as we go through are the affiliated generated quality leads or sales. Affiliates is a huge area where fraud can be enacted on merchants. One customer we just had actually had fraudsters steal music online, put it up on a site, become an affiliate, buy that music with stolen credit cards, and get the commissions. So they were selling the music that they stole, taking the commissions as an affiliate, and walking away with thousands of dollars every single month. They're very creative in how they can steal your money. But affiliates is an area where most merchants, they put that off to an affiliate group or an affiliate organization. And what you want to be able to do is track that for quality in the same way you would track a order that originates in your site. System gaming. People will actually have two or three merchant accounts so they can hide their fraud problems. Friendly fraud is another area. I mentioned that earlier. Friendly fraud is growing. One merchant that we work with said their friendly fraud size order is usually double their average order, and yet it's more difficult to detect and more difficult to find and get back. Some of the remedies we see, people simply turn off affiliate marketing. They simply turn off IP addresses if they see it's bad, like another country. They create multiple merchant accounts to hide their chargebacks. Or they try and build custom screening or deploy minimal fraud tools, like I said, CVV, ABS, in-house. And then there's, I know this sounds funny, but there's a large group of people that simply cross their fingers and say, we haven't been hit by fraud yet, we're just going to hold on. That's a pretty dangerous proposition. The best defense is a great offense. It's the best all around to put practices and strategies in place that match your business's practices for its tolerance of risk, for its tolerance of what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. Doing that up front and putting a fraud system in place that meets those performance criteria is paramount to making sure that we can boost or increase our sales to maximize our opportunities and decrease our fraud. I want to spend the next couple of slides just walking you through the count system and how this automatically looks at and screens and runs rules and manages fraud in a relatively short amount of time, in about 250 to 350 milliseconds, so it does not affect your purchase process.
Okay, you know what? Before we do that, sorry, it's Melissa again.
That's okay.
I just want to make sure to get some of these questions taken care of before, because you're talking about so many different great things. Several people have asked, what is friendly fraud? I actually was going to ask you this before, too, if you could just explain what that means.
Sure, not a problem at all. Friendly fraud is when the credentials used were not stolen, but when the product shows up or gets delivered, it is basically somebody lies and they say, I didn't receive that jacket. And you say, well, I've got your signed receipt here. And they go, that's not me. And it's very difficult to pull that sale back. Or if I've got children, one of my kids grabbed my credit card and orders a snowboard online, and I get it on my bill, and I look at it, and I go, I didn't order one of these, and I dispute the charge, but it really was somebody like my son buying that, and yet I'm disputing the charge. It's called friendly fraud. It's actually seen an increase in the last couple of years, and it's one of those things that's difficult to monitor. But we can put rules in place and strategies in place to help minimize that.
And also, are we talking about an in-store problem, or can it happen offline and online?
I'm talking offline. Things that happen either through a cataloger, mail order, online, those types of things.
Okay, perfect.
The difficulty there is simply because it's very difficult to prove somebody took ownership of that order. Even with signed documents from shipping companies, it's still very, very difficult. We've actually found one fraud group that would make orders and then wait at the person's house, sign for the order, 10 pairs of Nikes, and walk away.
Hmm.
And it's a difficult thing to do, but we can manage those and minimize some of that in some of the systems that we'll talk about here in just a second.
Okay. And also, another question was that one question was that you referred to friendly fraud as an operational problem. Just what do you mean by operational? I'm assuming you mean sort of in terms of the way the company is set up.
Well,
right?
I shouldn't have generalized it like that, but different companies put different tasks in different groups. Operationally, I took the order, it looked good, I shipped the order off, and now somebody is denying that. How do I go back and put that audit trail together? And sometimes that falls in finance, sometimes that falls in operations, sometimes it falls into the logistics and shipping department. So I didn't mean to generalize that. It's just wherever that task falls.
Got it.
Okay. Is where that comes.
Perfect. Okay, we can move on.
Okay, great. Any time. Just stop me. I'm happy to answer questions, so
okay.
Bring them on. Let's talk just for a couple of minutes about how the count system works as an integrated solution to help stop some of these issues that we see as regular fraud problems that will help increase sales as you go. So let's assume that we're a consumer, we're buying something online, the merchant has got his merchant account at a bank. The first thing that happens once a consumer, whether they're logging onto an account, creating a new account, purchasing something, signing up for a free trial, all those things are transactions that you want to look at and verify. The next thing that you would see is that that order or that information is sent to a real-time analytics review database. And in here, we will actually review a couple of hundred, sometimes in some cases up to 300 different data points, and pull that information out and through our own algorithms, weight each piece of the information, and then we'll send that information over to another area. The first thing you'll see is a count fraud score, and consider this something like a FICO score. When you go to take a loan out at a bank and you've got a credit score of 825, that doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a loan. What it tells the bank is that you're probably a pretty good risk. And the same happens if you've got a credit score of 520. That doesn't mean you're not going to get a loan. It just tells the bank that you're probably not a good risk. Think of the count score the same way. We will give you a score based on what we believe is the probability of fraud or the relative risk with that particular transaction. And then people will take that and they'll base some of the other actions that they take on it. So that fraud score, some of the data, the merchant supplied data, and all the other variables are sent over into our rules decision engine. That engine takes a look at the score and other rules that you put in place. And by the way, the average number of rules that a count client uses is less than 15, which makes for managing and maintenance extremely easy. Once the transaction goes to that rules decision engine, it's given a approve, decline, or I need more information. And that all happens in that 250 to 350 milliseconds, which does not slow down or deter orders or transactions in any way. But let's say that it's something we have to take a further look at. The next thing we'll do is we'll take that order that needed to have further review, and we send it to what's called an auto agent. And this agent does many of the things that a live manual review agent would do, and it automates them. It might go out to LexisNexis or Targus Info or 192.com and grab information that would help verify or confirm the information that you have so that you can make a better decision. Once that happens, that information is again fed into the risk engine, and it will make another decision. Do I approve, do I decline, or do I need further review? And that typically happens in about 1 to 3 seconds. And then the last thing, if it does need to have that human set of eyeballs take a look at it, the thing we want to do is make sure it goes through the system as quickly and efficiently as possible. So we have what's called a workflow queue manager. And what this does is it takes the attributes of the order, and based on your criteria, it will send that to the most appropriate review agent. So, for instance, let's say the person's computer was set to Spanish. I would probably want to send that order to be reviewed by a Spanish-speaking person. Or let's say the order originated in the UK. I may want to have a customer service rep in the UK take a look at that. And I can manage that queue any way I want to. And by doing this, we get to look at that order at least twice before a manual review agent takes it. And what we have found is most customers keep their manual review process to under 5%, many of them as low as 1% to 2%. Let's take just a minute. Unless you've got questions before the case study, let's take a minute and go through the case study.
Actually, let me go back and see some, if we have any questions. Let's see. We are getting quite a few. Okay, let's see. This is sort of another question about something you had said earlier that I missed, but you mentioned that having 2,000 rules indicated that the initial screening was not enough. Can you just explain initial screening?
Sure. Let me just back up here, and I'll show you what I mean. This big circle here that says real-time analytics, that's what I mean by initial screening. That initial screen looks at hundreds of variables and will give me an immediate yes, no, or maybe right there. And what's happening is if that initial screening is not strong enough or doesn't do enough of the work, the maybes become huge. And so now I've got to put other rules in place that say, gosh, if I get a maybe that looks like this, here's a rule for it. If I get a maybe that looks like this, here's another rule for it. And so the more rules that I've got means that I'm getting too many I don't know what to do with this order responses from my initial screen. Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me.
Okay. What we're trying to do is minimize the number of orders that have to be looked at again and again in order to be verified or declined. And so that initial screen, that big circle or octagonal thing, I don't know what shape that is, that's what we call the initial screen, and it runs through that rules engine, and it will make what we have found is about 97% of the orders or transactions that go through that in the count system are given a very clear, based on the rules, decline or accept, and that only about 3% of them go into that second and third review into the auto agent or into the manual review process. So if I'm writing more and more rules, it means my initial screening is not doing its work.
Got it.
Okay? Anything else?
Let's see. Some other questions are around chargebacks and average order issues. What is the average order rejection rate shared 2.4% for U.S. for online? Was that the average order rejection rate? She just wants to clarify a question.
Well,
a statistic.
Yeah. You bet. 2.4% of the orders in the U.S. are rejected because of suspicion of fraud. That's what that number is.
Got it.
So if you've got a system that's running less than that, you're a little better than average. More than that, you're a little worse than average. That's just a national average. And I think the survey looked at about 500 merchants of varying sizes. So it's an average. It's a mark to look at.
Okay. And what about the percentage of manual review process? Another question about a number that you talked about, or a percentage.
You bet. There's a couple of percentages you might want to use as benchmarks. One is the study that was just done for 2011 said about 27% on average orders are manually reviewed, which that means 1 out of 4. And if I've got a manually review 1 out of 4 orders, it means I'm slowing my process down. It's costly because I have human people looking at it. People looking at it. It's just a very costly way to do business. And what we like to do is reduce manual review as much as possible. Now, I realize there are some industries where manual review is simply a way of life. Blue Nile is a merchant that sells diamonds. Oftentimes, if an order exceeds a certain amount, they will make sure by giving the customer a phone call, emailing back and forth, just to verify. They've got a lot of money on the line there. But most often, we can reduce those manual reviews to less than 5%, and oftentimes in the 1% to 2% range. It's just a very costly way to do business, so we try and make that more efficient.
Okay, great. Okay, I think we can move on to the case study. I'm interested to hear that.
Okay, let's move this, and feel free to ask questions as you go. Bodybuilding.com is obviously a client of ours. They are the number one sports nutrition. They were purchased by Liberty Media a year before last, which puts them on number 11 in the Internet Retailer Top 500. Individually, they'd be about 152. So they're a larger group, but I think some of the symptoms that they have are very, very similar to things that we'll find of merchants of all sizes. Here's what they had in their situation. They had an in-house fraud system. They had people in-house managing their internal fraud controls. What they started to notice sort of over a number of months was that their chargeback rate started to slowly climb, and it really took about 8 to 10 months before they felt like their chargeback rate was out of control. And that's something we often find, is people will wait until it gets to a point where it's almost dangerous. But it doesn't creep up all at once, generally, unless you're hit by a fraud group that just nails you. It typically goes up very slowly. Their overseas sales were negatively affected because of their poor fraud detection. And that's a big problem for them, because 15% of their revenue came from the armed services customer who is deployed all over the world. So they couldn't just turn off countries. So they were being hit by a larger number of fraud instances as they went out. Their decline rate was climbing. Their manual review percentage was climbing. They were manually reviewing 1 in 3 orders, which is just unsustainable and certainly not scalable as you try and grow. Obviously, they use Count. They implemented it in less than 30 days. They started optimizing. They actually implemented it in about 2 weeks, and we had it totally optimized for their rules and everything in less than 30 days. Here's what happened. They had a chargeback rate reduction of over 85% in that first 30 days. They were in the excessive chargeback program, which was charging them about $110,000 a month in a fee because of their chargeback problem. So you can imagine the amount of relief that they saw. They took their chargeback rate down to where it currently is, between that 20 to 30 basis points, or 0.2 to 0.3 of 1%. Their reduction of decline orders dropped dramatically, 14% in that initial 30 days, and their overall decline rate is less than 1.5%, so well below the national average, and they're very happy with that. Here's the thing that shocked them, something that we've seen several times with merchants, but it shocked them. They saw a 5% overall increase in transactions that they could accept. They were throwing out a lot of orders, and we actually showed them, and they verified that they were getting a 5% increase in overall transactions. The response time, we mentioned between 250 and 350 milliseconds. Their average response time was 304 milliseconds, 99.5% of the time. There was no order disruption, so the orders were going through smoothly. Their efficiency increased because they were able to process orders more quickly. They actually took people off the manual review team and put them into customer service that actually helped generate sales. So they took people out of that fraud group and put them over to an area where they could actually help customers and increase sales. And now they're expanding into markets that they wouldn't have expanded to even a few months prior to having our system installed. Let me just summarize this. We've covered a lot of ground, and I know there's some questions. I want to leave plenty of time for questions. Managing fraud requires a complete strategy, something that mimics your business, not trying to twist your business to manage fraud, but manage fraud so you can get back to business. We think that's very important. A proper fraud management should not be inhibiting your ability to sell more, whether it's to more people, more products, more places. We want to make sure you maximize that and have complete confidence that what you do is going to be backed up by your fraud system. Again, too many rules may mean that initial screen is just not doing its job, which means you're doing more management and putting sales at risk because it doesn't work. Fraud management doesn't need to be a cost center. As we saw with bodybuilding, that by using that system, they actually increased sales. And the vice president of sales, I talked to him, and he said, I didn't have to put a dime into another promotion. I didn't hire another salesperson. I didn't put a discount on products, and yet I saw my sales go up. That was a happy guy when we got done with him there. So I think that's the end of my portion of the presentation. I'm going to turn it over to Stephanie, and feel free to ask some questions and answer those now. Excuse me, Melissa. Melissa?
Hi, yes, this is Melissa. Sorry about that mix-up there. This is working out really well. We do have some more questions, so and please send them in, we love the questions, and Don, you're doing a great job of answering them. One person wanted to know about the standard used for microchipped credit cards. I guess it's not yet generally made available in the U.S. Is that true? And can you kind of talk about that issue at all?
You bet. It's called chip and PIN, and Europe has been using it for a long time. And for the most part, chip and PIN is for POS merchants, where you're actually standing in front of a POS agent with a teller or a cashier there. That was where Europe was having a lot of fraud, and they imposed the chip and PIN standard. It does help in some instances. The problem is the fraudster networks they've integrated that. They can steal your credit card, and they'll steal your PIN. It's when they do account takeover or when they do login fraud, all those things, botnets that they use and other Trojans will steal not only the card number but the card code and the PIN that goes with it. So for online, it's still not as effective as it is maybe in front of a cashier at a store. So I hope that answers the question there. It's something we probably should adopt because it will stop some of the face-to-face fraud, but online fraud, it's still a little bit more difficult to calculate how much of an impact that's had because it hasn't had much in Europe.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Europe and international, several folks wanted to know about AVS for international. Like, is there international AVS? Is that something that is available or that you guys offer, I guess? Or
there are some equivalents when you talk to payment processors that manage international processes, cross-border payments, things like Chase Payment Tech, Planet Payment, some of those that will have some of those. But once again, those pieces of data are static, and it's very easy for fraudsters to mimic and mask those pieces of information. Those should be a given. Everybody should have those, but I certainly wouldn't rely on those as a major portion of my fraud management system.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. One gentleman has, this is his second email, so we better get this one answered.
Okay.
He received three chargebacks with a recent transaction, I guess, and he wanted to know if the account system is prepared to screen orders that go through PayPal. That's actually a good question in general.
One of the advantages of our system is we don't care what kind of payment it is. It can be gift card, PayPal, bill me later, credit cards, debit cards, even checks. We don't determine our fraud system based on the method of payment. We don't care if it comes from a phone, using a PayPal. It doesn't really matter. Our system will screen all of those things in the same manner, so merchants don't have to have two or three systems to accomplish one fraud screen. It's a great question because PayPal with eBay has become a very, very major portion of the payment industry today. One of our customers that does about 50,000 transactions a day, about 32% of those transactions are PayPal. So you can see it's a huge portion of that payment processing option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, another person wanted to know if the system helps alleviate risk for third-party payment methods. He was talking about international unconfirmed PayPal customers, but it sounds like the same kind of a thing. This is an interesting question. One of our listeners just had an attack through a virtual terminal associated to the company but never used. So in that kind of a situation, can you talk about who's responsible for the missing funds and then obviously how to protect yourself from these kinds of attacks?
One of the things that is a general rule for anybody in card not present or customer not present operations is the merchant is 100% liable for those losses. What will happen is if I see something on my card that I can't verify, I don't think I did it, I think somebody stole it and did that, I call my bank. The bank calls either Visa or wherever they're merchants, and that money is pulled out of the merchant account until it's resolved. And online, merchants are 100% liable for that, as well as chargeback fees and fines that go with that. It's a difficult thing to prove otherwise because they're, once again, online, it's very difficult to prove that somebody did what you're saying they did. And in the U.S., the customer is always right and the merchant is almost always wrong. Very few cases can you go back and prove that. Now, there are ways to submit chargebacks to try and go against what the customer says, but it's going to cost you $25 or $30 to make the attempt, and only about 1 in 3 are successful. So it's a difficult thing to do.
Okay. That's great. Let's see. Can you talk about best practices or best business practices around sending address information over to a merchant for a valid ABS response, like billing or shipping information or both?
I think that really depends on the processor that you're using, the information that you need as a merchant. We tell most merchants, get as little information as you can to make it a process complete, just because the more information that's there, it's more difficult for your processor. We don't want to make the customer fill out too much information, things like MasterCard secure code and verified by Visa. If they've got to fill those things out, the conversion rates drop like crazy. That would be a question I'd probably want to answer one-on-one to see what their particular instance is so I can give them more than just general information.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be happy to do that if I'll have the questions afterwards. I'll follow up.
Okay, great. Another question is, one of our listeners' fraud seems to be 99% online orders that are shipped to third-party addresses, so not the billing address, obviously. So that's 99% of their orders. I mean, what are the other types of fraud that you're seeing? I mean, you talked a little bit about this at the beginning, but can you maybe refresh what you had mentioned about in terms of the types of fraud?
Oftentimes when somebody's information has been exposed, you will see little pieces of fraud where it's a $10 order and they don't look at their credit card statement very well, and so this goes on and on and on for months before people even notice that it's happening. Or we'll see something called card testing. And this happens especially with sites that have free trials or very low-cost items. What criminals will do is they'll go online, they'll buy a group of 100 or 1,000 credit card numbers with the credentials, and then they'll go test them. And they'll go to a place where they can buy a 99-cent app. Or they'll sign up for a free trial that needs a credit card for approval, even though it's free. And if they get approval on those things, then they know those cards are good. And they'll either go resell them or they'll start stealing stuff. And so card testing is becoming more and more popular, especially on low-cost items, game sites, free trial sites, and so forth. One of the things that I didn't mention that I think it's very important here is with Count, we do something called dynamic scoring. You saw the Count score that we talked about earlier in the presentation. Most systems take a look at a transaction, and when they've made their decision, they move on, and that transaction is dead at that point. What Count does is we monitor that transaction for 14 days, and every 30 minutes, we will upgrade that transaction. If we see signals of fraud, we will upgrade that score so the merchant, especially merchants that do shippable goods, they'll have an opportunity before that good leaves their store to do another check on that and see if that fraud screening has changed. Let me give you an idea. Somebody steals a credit card. Within 24 hours, 86% of the fraud on that card is going to happen in that first 24 hours. So I see somebody come to my site. They make an order. Everything looks really good. I approve it. It goes on its way. And then I see within our system that same email, that same credit card, that same ship-to address go to another order and another order. Or I link that. We have what's called merchant linking, order linking. I can link that order to millions of transactions across the globe. And if I can link that to something that's already been fraud, I can register that with the merchant, and the merchant can see that fraud score go up and up and up and up. Once that score is given, we monitor that for 14 days. So you can monitor if your purchases are from fraud networks because you'll watch those scores increase as that happens.
We're very sorry for the technical difficulties during this webinar. But on behalf of Retail Online Integration and Count, I want to thank you all for attending the webinar. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get more information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. Hope to see you at the next webinar.